This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, women in business and politics are being praised for acting like cutthroat capitalists and warmongering men. But is that feminism? And a leader of South Africa's newly formed Socialist Revolutionary Workers' Party explains why workers must take political power in that country.
But first, Dr. Martin Luther King is widely known as a civil rights leader, but he was also deeply committed to the labor movement. Peter Cole teaches African American history at the University of Western Illinois. Cole is the author of the book, Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area. He says labor issues were a top priority of Dr. King, who early on saw himself as a kind of socialist.
In the 1950s, he does talk about and write about, including from what we see, letters to his future wife, Coretta Scott, that he's sort of questioning capitalism and as being immoral, and that he often in the 60s calls himself some sort of democratic socialist. But separate from that is his awareness that the great majority of Black Americans are working class and poor. And so the question then becomes, well, how do we make these people less poor before we evolve into a democratic socialist society, perhaps? And as King said, the greatest anti-poverty program are unions, and that therefore Blacks had a material interest in sort of organizing unions because they would be less poor as a result. And so that's also not sort of as much part of his conversation and sort of public persona in the 1950s, although it is worth noting that in the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, 1956, one of the leaders of the boycott is a man named E.D. Nixon, who's the head of the NAACP in Alabama, but also is the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in his part of the country. And that's a famous Black majority union that was founded, co-founded by A. Philip Randolph, right? And so even in the 50s, he's starting to, really at the birth of his activism, because the Montgomery bus boycott is what launches King when he's just in his first job, right? That even then he's seeing how collective action helps, but specifically how unions can sort of be involved. In the 1960s, we see more and more evidence of King reaching out to different labor unions. The largest collection of unions belong to what's called the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations, or AFL-CIO. So even in the early 60s, there's examples of King speaking before gatherings of unions where he talks about how Black Americans and unionists have common interests because, as he puts it, most Black people are working people or working class people. And then, as many of us also know, across the 1960s, he becomes in many ways more radical, both before and after his 1963 I Have a Dream speech. And so by the later parts of his short life, that he's speaking out more and more about how unions can be very effective tools for Black people to enter the middle class. Yeah, and of course, most famously, it's when he's killed in 1968. It's while he's in Memphis, Tennessee, when he's organizing to help Black sanitation workers form a union.
Well, in 1967, Dr. King was named an honorary member of Local 10 of the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union. That's one of the most militant and progressive labor formations in the country. Tell us about his special relationship with them.
Of course. The ILWU is the union of dock workers on the U.S. West Coast. On the East Coast and the Gulf Coast, there's actually a different union. And the union on the West Coast broke away from the East Coast Union in the 1930s. really over political divisions. And to oversimplify matters, essentially the West Coast Union was led by and had more rank and file members who were more left-wing in the 1930s during the Great Depression, whereas the leadership of the New York City-based East Coast Union was considered much more conservative, more mainstream, and also actually much less inclusive. So the West Coast Union was much more open to organizing workers other than white workers in principle. But in practice, the San Francisco Bay Area local, which was called Local 10, and San Francisco Bay Area was the busiest and largest port, and so was the most important and largest local in this union, took a very principled stand early on in the late 1930s to include black people in the membership, to integrate their work gangs, and to treat blacks equally within their union. And over the course of the 1940s, due to the Great Migration and due to labor shortages during World War II, suddenly there's a lot more black people who live in the San Francisco Bay Area. Some thousands of those black men get work on the waterfront in San Francisco and in Oakland. And this union, which already exists, it allows them into the union fully and treats them pretty equally. By the mid-1960s, Local 10 of the LWU is roughly half black. By the late 1960s, has elected its first local president, African-American, a man named Cleophas Williams, who I interviewed late in his life. And as a result of really 30-plus years of civil rights activism on the part of this union, King, who is familiar with many different unions, travels to San Francisco in 1967, where he's inducted into the union as an honorary member and spends a day and speaks at the Union's Hall in San Francisco and talks about, as Cleophas later said, the economics of discrimination. Cleophas, like Martin Luther King and like the founding president of the LWU, Harry Bridges, really sort of are speaking to what many of us now would call racial capitalism, that you cannot separate race and class issues, and that really to attack racism, you also have to sort of start to question capitalism. And simultaneously, if your goal is to sort of overcome capitalism, that you need all hands on deck. So you would be unwise if you did not include African Americans and other people of color from your movement, because you're only going to weaken yourself. And so King and Harry Bridges, along with thousands of members of Local 10, black and white, really sort of share this political ideology. And that's why King visits San Francisco, is inducted into Local 10 as an honorary member, and speaks at their Union Hall, which is the subject of a short essay I wrote recently.
And the story of the dock workers is fascinating and inspiring, because the dock workers went from being among the most exploited workers to among the best represented, the best paid, but they did not lose their militancy.
That is very interesting. And so with unions often come sort of improved material conditions. Union members get paid better, often have access to, say, retirement and health benefits, generally have safer workplaces. All those things are good. I have no problem with any group of workers wanting to sort of improve their material conditions. The sort of interesting parts, right, of ILWU is that sometimes when people get wealthier and better off, they sort of forget their roots and become more conservative. But by contrast, the ILWU, especially its flagship local, Local 10, as you said, maintains its militancy and really going beyond just its own members' benefits to sort of fight on behalf of different social justice causes. That included the civil rights movement. So that, for instance, in the 1960s, if in the San Francisco Bay Area, more of us are familiar with the Southern-based civil rights movement. But in many cities outside the South, there were, in the wake of the Southern movement, efforts by blacks and white allies to sort of overcome racism. So that, for instance, in the Bay Area in 1964, there was a series of sit-ins and protests to protest racism in the Bay Area, including in the workplace, you know, better hiring and treatment and promotion and pay for black and other non-white workers. The LWU was involved in those sorts of struggles. That actually also goes back to the World War II effort, to the World War II era. So, for instance, during World War II, the first black men are hired to drive trolleys in the streetcar system in San Francisco. And literally the first black guy who's hired on his first shift is beaten up by some white people for being black. Members of Local 10 essentially volunteer to defend this black streetcar driver and so ride with him during his shift to defend him from potential future attacks, right? And so it's not even in the 60s, but even going back into the 1940s, that this union, which was predominantly white, but nevertheless had some black members, is fighting for not just inclusion in their own workplaces, but also more generally equal treatment in workplaces generally, but also sort of in American society most broadly, right? And I would say that one of the main reasons for why so many whites in this union were anti-racist was because they were left-wing in their political orientation. And they very much saw that, again, sort of that workers are much stronger if they are not divided based on race, nationality, gender, et cetera, or for that matter, skill or craft. And so this union is unusual. I wouldn't say it's one of a kind, but it's unusual. And there are other unions that also are somewhat similar in this way. But in the Bay Area, really, I say the tip of the spear of the civil rights movement is actually these dock workers who are not only working to improve their own conditions and wages, but also working on behalf of equality at a very broad sense.
The title of your book is Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area. And of course, Durban refers to South Africa. Local 10 is also, of course, notable for its internationalism.
Yeah, so my book is actually a comparison of dock workers in the San Francisco Bay Area, which used to be the largest and most important port in the American West Coast, although in recent decades, Los Angeles is more important. And then Durban, which is not only the most important and busiest port in South Africa, but actually the most busy port in all of Africa for really the better part of 100 years. And so I studied and wrote a lot of my book dealing how Durban dock workers are in their own country, in their own city, sort of fighting for racial equality, which in South Africa was called the anti-apartheid movement. But as you said, part of my book also deals with international efforts on the part of these workers. And so dock workers in the Bay Area, starting in the early 1960s and continuing through the 1980s, saw themselves as part of this global movement against apartheid, apartheid being a system of racial oppression that made Jim Crow segregation look like a joke, apartheid being far more severe. And so, interestingly, also because of their left-wing politics, as well as the fact that a growing number of Local 10 members themselves are African-American and have some sympathies for Africans in their ancestral home, increasingly refused to work cargo from South Africa in order to try to exert pressure on the United States and South Africa to abandon the system of apartheid. And the most dramatic example comes in 1984, where for 10 days, dock workers in San Francisco refused to touch cargo from South Africa to protest the treatment of blacks and other non-white South Africans. And that is, as you say, internationalist, because not only are they taking action in their own community, in their own country, they're engaging in actions for which, you know, honestly, they can't, metaphorically, they benefit from a better world, you could say. But, you know, materially, the fact that they are stopping work means that they're not getting paid, right? That they're refusing to work on behalf of a struggle that's thousands of miles away with people that few of them have ever met before is amazing, right? Because very few of us are willing to put our jobs on the line, let alone to sacrifice some of our money on behalf of a cause, a social justice cause in a far distant land.
And in the context of internationalism, you make the connection between Dr. King and folks who came before, specifically Paul Robeson.
Right. So Paul Robeson is familiar to many of us. He's an African-American man who's father, right, had been, I believe, born a slave, and who's a generation older than King. But Robeson was an actor and a singer, as well as an activist. I always tell my students, I'm a professor, that Paul Robeson is like if you were to combine the popular music of Kanye West and the acting of, I don't know, Jamie Foxx or Denzel Washington, that Robeson was the most prominent black actor and black musician of his generation. But he was also, as many of us know, an outspoken political activist, critical of racism in America, critical of capitalism in America and worldwide. And Robeson, for similar reasons as King, found his way to the ILWU several of his friends, other black radicals, were members of the union, the ILWU. And so Robeson in the 1940s was also inducted as an honorary member of the ILWU, so that Robeson in the mid-20th century and then King in the sort of the late 1960s, both, it's quite noteworthy that this union has this connection to two of the most prominent African-Americans, well, in the history of the United States, period, right?
So we see that Local 10 is a prominent part of both the black radical tradition and the radical labor tradition.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of putting it. There was a historian who wrote a book about 15 years ago, actually, about a group of left-wing whites and blacks in North Carolina who are tobacco workers. But he used a term in the title of his book, Civil Rights Unionism. And so ILWU was another example of an American union that was using its economic power on the job, not just to improve their own lives and material conditions, but also to sort of fight for causes beyond their workplaces. In these cases, against racial segregation and in favor of black equality. And so I like the way you put that. Yes, part of the black radical tradition as well as really part of a militant labor union tradition.
Now, that local has been heavily automated, has far fewer members, but it still retains that radical tradition.
Yeah. So as in many industries, automation or new technologies that displace workers has been a major force on the waterfronts around the world. As a result of that, we call it actually containerization, when 20 to 40 foot metal boxes basically are how we move goods around the world nowadays since the 1960s. The San Francisco Bay Area is one of the first ports in the world that was containerized in a significant way. And like you said, one of the implications of that, one of the effects of that, is a much smaller workforce. In the case of the Bay Area and the entire U.S. West Coast, and for that matter nowadays the other coasts in America, dock workers, because of their strong unions, actually get paid quite well. I joke on more than one occasion that union dock workers in San Francisco or Los Angeles get paid better than many professors, which is my own profession. But that has come, nevertheless, at sort of a significant price. I mean, in the 21st century, we workers, whatever sort of work we do, should be aware that technology can make our lives easier, but they also might make our work useless. We might be fired because essentially a machine of some sort or another does our job for us. So the union made major concessions in the 1960s on the U.S. West Coast when they agreed that containers could move forward. At the same time, the union, led by at that time still Harry Bridges, got some extraordinary concessions out of the employers, most importantly that not a single person was fired, right? And so essentially everyone was guaranteed a job in that particular union and that sort of on the West Coast, and the employers put up a bunch of money to essentially buy out older dock workers, so what they called shrinking from the top, as opposed to firing the young. I mean, that's, even though imperfect, because long term there are fewer jobs, the way that the union was able to negotiate this transition is noteworthy, but it was only because there was a strong union. By contrast, in the San Francisco side of my book, in Durban, containers came a generation or 15 years later, but because of apartheid, black workers were much weaker, and the port of Durban and other ports in South Africa did not negotiate the process with a black union or their black workers. Instead, they just instituted this massive change, and within 3 years had fired half the workforce. And so in both cases, these workers were able to sort of survive and in some cases thrive and reorganize, but the contrast between how Durban dockers and San Francisco longshoremen were treated is quite stark, and one example of how unions can matter greatly in protecting workers. One of the points I like to make about Martin Luther King's relationship with the ILWU, which is really interesting and is particular to the waterfront, if you will, is that when King was killed less than a year after he had visited Local 10 in September of 1967, he's killed in April of 1968, the day after, the ILWU Local 10 stopped work, because before that time and to this very day, if a member of the union is killed on the job, they actually shut down for that shift. They don't go back to work. And despite the fact that employers hate this sort of independent worker power, dock workers still do this up and down the U.S. West Coast. So King is killed on April 4th. The following day, the ports of Oakland and San Francisco don't work, right? Out of respect for a fallen member who had died in Memphis, but nevertheless was considered a member of the Union. Even though Oakland was also not only sort of where ILWU Local 10, many members lived, it's also the birthplace of the Black Panther Party, which is considered to be this supposedly anti-white, yet very militant, radical black organization. The truth of the matter is that the Black Panthers and the dock workers kept Oakland quiet. And so while more than 100 cities and towns across the United States went up in smoke because black men and women were so angered by the killing of Martin Luther King that they just engaged in random property violence, right? Oakland, despite the stereotype that the Panthers are so crazy and violent, in fact, Oakland was quiet. And there's probably multiple explanations for that, not a single one, but that the dock workers shut down the port, that actually the Panthers literally tried to keep the community, the black community in the East Bay, quiet. They succeeded, right? And so it's very interesting and sort of really also goes against the grain of what some people think they know about the Panthers. But also what they don't know about the dock workers is that in this case, in Oakland in April of 68, the city didn't go up the way Chicago, Washington, D.C., and a number of other places did, which is a sort of curious footnote to the story.
That was Dr. Peter Cole of the University of Western Illinois.
Women are engaged in all kinds of activities these days, including war, torture, and cutthroat corporation business. But is that progress? Dean Spade is a professor at the Seattle University School of Law and co-author of a recent article titled, There's Nothing Feminist About Imperialism.
It's true. I've recently published an article with Sarah Lazar about our concern because we saw all of these media celebrations of women in high places, celebrating that women are the CEOs of the top five military contractors and that Gina Haspel was appointed to head the CIA, and so that women are in all of these places inside the military-industrial complex, and this was kind of hailed with these articles that said a number of things. One, the suggestion that this is some kind of victory for women or for women's well-being, and two, there's also an implication that somehow the military-industrial complex is a like meritocracy, like a more fair, non-sexist working environment than other industries. And we were aghast for a number of reasons. Certainly this is a way to celebrate and give good PR to those very agencies like the CIA or those organizations like Lockheed Martin that, of course, left movements oppose and seek to dismantle. But also, given the last many years of exposés about sexual violence in the U.S. military and the fact that 38% of women military personnel have been victims of assault and that 40% of homeless veterans who are women have been victims of sexual assault, the idea that it's easy to climb inside that organization and that it's so good to women is such an outrage. So both in terms of what happens to women inside the military and also what, of course, the military does in the world, which is responsible for extreme violence that disproportionately affects women, this whole framing was just outrageous to us.
Yes, and the military-industrial complex is actively marketing that feminist angle. Raytheon, one of the biggest military contractors in the United States, has partnered with the Girl Scouts.
Yes, and I think that for us, for me, it makes a lot of sense to look at that kind of PR move alongside just more broadly the popularity for all kinds of violence-making and harm-doing institutions to associate themselves with progressive politics or with targeted populations. So for me, this goes alongside with seeing, a couple of years ago, the New York Police Department put out a police car that had a rainbow flag on it to sort of say we're a gay-friendly police department, which is pretty common in many police departments around the country, or to see the ways that oil companies want to market themselves as green energy, or any of these strategies to just notice the ways that these kinds of bait-and-switch moves or this kind of propaganda that would suggest the very opposite of what these organizations are about is a common feature, and it's not a new feature at all, but it's something that seems increasingly sophisticated and popular with a number of institutions that are branding themselves as progressive through saying they're women-friendly or gay-friendly or green.
And in this propaganda, some of these companies are saying that women bring some special feminine traits to the war industry.
Yeah, there's a fascinating sort of sexist and gender essentialist narrative which is really a gender essentialist about a particular vision of white womanhood that is visible in these celebratory moments about women leading the defense industry. There was a really fascinating thing in the Politico article that celebrated this that said both that women are such great people for the defense industry because they're naturally protective mothers, so this sexist idea about women's gender roles as parents, and then also this idea that women come up with these like novel, interesting solutions because they have this different other experience. And the example was that a woman had come up with covering sensitive equipment with pantyhose in the desert to not have sand get into the equipment. So this, you know, it's really reasserting a notion of essentialist gender difference that we could say is the opposite of a feminist insight.
Yes, I suppose if one discovered that some of the executioners on Texas's death row were female, that would be heralded as a victory for women's liberation.
Well, I think in some ways that's exactly right. I mean, that's where this logic goes. It's that any population should know it's free when it has the opportunity to become executioners, police, soldiers, when it has an opportunity to work inside the very institutions and systems that produce harm for those very populations. So it's this, you know, very backward idea of liberation that doesn't at all accord with the kinds of robust anti-racist, feminist, anti-imperialist politics that I think feminism is actually about. It's like this stripping of that to just be like, if we have women's faces in these places, then we'll declare a victory.
I remember when the Obama administration came in and there was somewhat of a debate about whether the U.S. should withdraw from Afghanistan. Folks were saying that the reason the U.S. should stay in Afghanistan is because of women and girls, that it was necessary for the U.S. to stay there so that they wouldn't fall into the clutches of the Taliban. But I also remember that the U.S. and the Saudi Arabians were the ones who funded those jihadists in Afghanistan who were bringing down a left-wing government there, which was actually fielding women to put girls in school and put women in all fields of professions. And the U.S. fielded the jihadists that overthrew that government.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most visible moments of this kind of politics in recent memory is Laura Bush's speech urging that the U.S. go to war in Afghanistan. And I think that very unpopular, extremely long, failed war has again and again been rationalized through the idea that somehow the war will benefit women. And that's a very old idea. You know, when we look back at lots of instances of colonization and of military intervention, there's often a story that we need to save women from the backward cultures they're in. That's a typical racist colonial story. And I think we saw Barbara Bush play it out in the George W. Bush era, but we continue to see it as a rationalization in general for the war on terror. Part of the Islamophobia that circulates says that Muslim countries or Muslim culture is bad for women, or sometimes it says it's bad for gay people, and that's a rationale for these wars. I think that, you know, Hillary Clinton's famous speech as a Secretary of State where she said gay rights are human rights, that speech, if you look at the text of it, really is a speech about how we're going to protect these rights through humanitarian war. So we don't really care what happens to the queer and trans people who are in the prisons and detention centers and homeless in the United States. We just care about finding new rationalizations, new humanitarian rationalizations for war.
Yes, this false feminist angle has been a pillar of U.S. humanitarian military interventions based on human rights rationales.
Exactly.
I also remember at Hillary Clinton's nominating convention in 2016, she wallowed in the endorsements of generals and top spies as if a woman ascending to the head of the U.S. imperial machine was a great achievement for women.
Yeah, I mean, she's such a good example, as is Obama, of this exact moment of marketing where these systems need to put the bodies of those who have been targets, but also whose bodies are associated with movements for freedom, into leadership of these very machines in order to try to find ways to make those machines to sort of borrow credit from those freedom struggles. I think the projections people have on a black president or a female presidential candidate or a female head of state or head of the CIA, those projections are supposed to smooth over the brutal realities that are more and more exposed with every passing day, especially in the era of WikiLeaks, et cetera, that have really, you know, added another level of delegitimization to these very operations. Not that they needed new levels, but this exposure is, you know, constantly happening, and there's kind of a scramble, I think, to use these tropes to produce good PR for these institutions.
The U.S. aggression against Libya also had a gender angle. Supposedly, Muammar Gaddafi's troops were woofing down vast quantities of Viagra and on a rape spree against women, and the United States had to save Libya from that.
Yes, as I understand it, that couldn't be confirmed by international organizations, and so we don't know what was really happening there, but it's clear that those talking points were part of the same logic, as was the idea that the military invasion was led by women. That was, you know, another one of the pieces the news picked up, and that was promoted by the military to suggest that this was a humanitarian intervention.
Have we had an imperial hijack of the feminist movement in part in the United States?
I don't know, because I'm not sure that it's new. I just think it's the same trope showing its face again. I mean, I think again and again, especially we see a very thinned out version of supposedly pro-women politics that's not really feminist, right? That's just this exact thing. You know, we're going to have a woman lead something horrible that, of course, produces more violence and harm and death to women and girls around the world, is, I think, just another iteration of something we've seen throughout colonial history, which is this idea that war and invasion are somehow to save or rescue women or is good for women. I think a new element of this, especially since the U.S. military removed the ban on women in certain forms of service, I think a new element of this is the idea, but it's also not new, but the idea that women in leadership inside the military, inside the defense industry, is itself proof that those industries are not sexist or will make those industries even more feminist. Like, that entire idea, you know, is similar to ones we see about any marginalized group at the moments when they're fighting to join the military or when they get appointed to lead particular parts of the military. So these are pretty well-worn strategies, but we do see new iterations of them all the time.
Yes, it seems like a counterpoint to the idea of counting black faces in high places and celebrating that, even if those faces are war criminals.
I think it's a very similar thing, and I think, you know, right now we're seeing the Supreme Court decision that recently came out in the ongoing discussion about whether or not trans people can serve in the military, and I see a very similar limiting framework where it gets cast in the media, including the supposedly progressive media, as just a question of whether trans people get this dignity and this equality and can we serve, when of course that obscures all the realities about what the U.S. military is, what the conditions of service are for people, what really happens to people inside the military, the ways that they're abandoned by the VA, and with a question of whether or not military service, this idea that you're protecting your country or that you're like a hero, as opposed to that this is part of bringing the largest amounts of violence and pollution and harm to people all around the world.
That was author and Seattle University professor Dean Spade.
South Africa has been under black political rule for the past 25 years since the end of apartheid. But the African National Congress government left control of the economy in the hands of white business interests. The gap between rich and poor has gotten even bigger. After decades of frustration, activists centered in the nation's largest labor union, NUMSA, the National Union of Metal Workers, last year formed a new political party to fight against white monopoly capitalist rule. Irvin Jim is the leader of NUMSA and a key architect of the new Socialist Revolutionary Workers' Party. Last week, he traveled to New York City to speak with American activists at the People's Forum.
I do want to say, comrades, that we are in the facing the same challenges, the same struggles, the same front. Coming together must inspire us, must continue to strengthen our resolve, for us to continue to believe that the history of all existing societies is a history of class struggle.
Yes.
And it's one thing to say I'm here to report, but I'm here to say that the struggle continues. We have been here before, and we have explained that our resolve was that we sick and tired of just marching, taking up campaigns, demands, up until we will have rickets. And we were very clear that the time has come that the working class as a class must organize itself, because the working class is the only class capable of carrying the revolution to its logical conclusion.
Yes.
We have come through the era of all liberation movements that have fought a good fight to challenge the apartheid system and all racist accumulation path. And capitalism as a system has always been very smart in all regions of the globe. It will choose racism. Race, for instance, in our case in South Africa, in some regions they will choose religion to divide so that it can exploit. But right through to take the struggle in the Cold War phase that we have to embark upon, it was the working class, it was sons and daughters of the working class who took those sacrifices within the liberation movements. And in our case, we would not have survived if it was not this pillar of struggle, which is international solidarity, solidarity with the people of Palestine. I'm very happy to say comrades here who are seriously organizing, solidarity with the people of Cuba, solidarity with the rest of Latin America, people of Venezuela. We're coming here to basically share with you that as the international core that has come together right from here, comrades from US who are working with us, comrades from South Africa, Zambia, and the rest of the continent, we're very clear that you can't build socialism in one country. Internationalism is an important pillar. And as a union, we came before, we had to struggle dealing with huge challenges of a liberation movement whose revolution has completely gone wrong. I was showing Roy this afternoon a situation where key leaders of our liberation alliance, there's a long list of how they've been captured by capital. There is a state capture commission that is being staged in our own country. But I mean, they're dealing with the surface. They're not dealing with colonization. They're not dealing with imperialism. And if you were to ask why the revolution in South Africa didn't deliver the liberation vision, it's very simple. The capitalist class, white monopoly capital that own and control, that used to benefit out of imperialism, out of colonization, they were very clear that to the extent that the working class was mobilized to take up the struggle to defeat the system of racism, when we made sure that apartheid was not going to be allowed to continue, when we made sure that it was ungovernable, they had to sit down and strategize. They strategized and they said, what did we fear out of this liberation alliance led by the ANC? They started a negotiation process. They cut a deal with the liberation alliance to make sure that the economy will remain in their own hands, and will continue to vote every after 5 years. And therefore, the whole system just continued by other means. All what it did was to change faces. This is not the only South Africa that is faced with this in the continent. As we speak, I'm sure you have watched for the past 2 weeks, the people of Zimbabwe are in a crisis. I mean, they have removed a very old man who refused to relinquish power. He got replaced by another very old man who refused to relinquish power. He's not new, but you can come to South Africa. It was Jacob Zuma. His deputy, Cyril Ramaphosa, just took over power. Is there a liberation agenda? Is there a revolutionary agenda for fundamental change? There's absolutely no intention to deal with the fundamentals of addressing ownership of the economy. For instance, in our case, fundamentally what we need is to restructure South African economy. Those who know South African economy, it is minerals, energy, and finance complex. It continues to be in the hands of a tiny minority. And of course, we can vote, and we continue to do every after 5 years. But the quality of life of our people does not change because we're not changing power relations in society. But that's the case in Zimbabwe. The land question, which is the landmark of whether the revolution really achieved its purpose, was still packed in the Land Act of 1913, where basically 87% of the whole population is basically packed like sardines in the township. And township, comrades, remains inferior infrastructure, inferior schools, inferior hospitals, inferior everything. But the very same population continues to deliver wealth, which basically is taken out of the country. It belongs into a tiny minority, and which means that apartheid was just removed in statute books, but it continues by other means. So what did we do? We happen to be a union that has been internally in the Liberation Alliance with activists. And I think the old Communist Party used to have a book like this called 50 Fighting Years of Sacrifice, because it was communists who sacrificed the most. It was communists who gave the best when the regime was brutal. It was communists who formed Umkhonto weSizwe with the military wing. It was communists who took all the risks against colonization and imperialism. And when they did everything when it comes to negotiations and it failed, they actually had to assert that there comes a time in the history of any nation whether to submit or to fight. Yes. And they chose to fight. And in that process, they had to do what you're doing here in this forum of having debate, discussion, raising each other's levels of revolutionary theory. A person without politics is very dangerous.
Yes.
Which is why it's very important that we must appreciate that there can be no revolutionary movement forward without revolutionary theory.
Yes.
And therefore, political classes where one or two comrades are given chance to basically unpack the literature, to engage, is fundamental to do so. And out of that, as the sons and daughters of the working class in South Africa who happen to be privileged to belong to a very, very strange union, a very strange creature, the National Union of Metal Workers, which I'm privileged to be their general secretary. This union had a very serious preamble. And the preamble called on all workers to set aside all their prejudice and unite. It called on workers to understand that capitalism moved from one nation state to another nation state. When they arrive, they're called investment. But capital, there's no free lunch. What drives that movement is where they will be able to maximize profit. In our case, this was done at the back of super exploitation of black and African labor on what is defined as colonial wage. And as I'm speaking to you, that colonial wage with what we call freedom has not been tampered with. In fact, Cyril Ramaphosa has delivered to his class, he is a billionaire.
Yes.
He has delivered to his class, he has made sure that he put into law a national minimum wage, which basically say black and African workers must be paid 20 rand an hour. I don't know if you translate 20 rand or into
a dollar 25.
It's 25.
A dollar. Just over a dollar.
So that's what he believed, that an hour the black and African labor must be paid. And against all that, we have to take a stand. Every after 5 years, we promise a better life for all. It doesn't get delivered. We took a firm stand that we will organize the working class as a class for itself. And Comrades, you might not believe it. The only class capable of having the revolution that should sort out these miseries is the working class. All what we need to do, those of us who are in position of being privileged to serve it, is to believe in it, is to believe that the working class is capable of carrying this particular revolution to its logical conclusion. And that's what we did. We said, without knowing who will come and stand together with us, we said, the time has come that we will form a united front, we'll agitate the working class, and we will tell the working class, you need your own political party, which must be a vanguard party, which must take up the struggle for socialism. Those are the good news we want to bring to you. That we had a successful pre-launch, and the Congress took a couple of two important decisions. It resolved that we will participate in elections. There's election taking place. We will participate in the elections that are going to take place now in May. We have taken that resolution. Secondly, we will launch the party in March. And when I say that on the ground, our own branches, our own structures are working 24/7, we will have a Socialist Revolutionary Workers' Party being formally launched. It has been recognized and registered by the IEC, as we have promised you that we are in that course. And of course, this is going to be nothing else. This is viewed as nothing less than a declaration of war, because we are not forming this party to be another reformist party. We want to take up a struggle against capitalism as a system, because we firmly believe that capitalism as a system does not have solutions for problems that confront humanity. We want to overthrow capitalism in South Africa with its concentration and centralization of wealth in the hands of a tiny minority that is dying of overeating, whilst the bulk majority of our people are dying of hunger and starvation. And solidarity for us must be about the struggle to ensure that we deliver socialism and class struggle, which can only be successful if we build this international solidarity with people of Venezuela, with Cuba, with Palestine, to expose all those nationalists who occupy positions of power in the continent and the rest of the world to continue to give us a prescription of a system that continues to produce all our miseries and all our social ills. Tonight, that's what, in our view, we should be strengthening ourselves to talk about. Amanda. Thank you very much.
That was Irvin Jim of South Africa's newly formed Socialist Revolutionary Workers' Party.
Also on hand at the People's Forum was Dr. Cosmas Musomali, the General Secretary of the Socialist Party of the Southern African Nation of Zambia. The ruling party of Zambia has declared the Socialist Party to be a danger to national security, and party members are under constant danger of imprisonment. Dr. Musomali told his New York audience that the imperialist powers have enlisted African governments as collaborators in neocolonialism.
There's a scramble for African land. We have hundreds of thousands of hectares that are being leased or sold to foreign entities.
Yes.
South Korea is getting hundreds of thousands of hectares of land. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, India, France, Germany, the US to a limited extent.
Mm-hmm.
But with land also comes water. Agriculture is about land, it's about water. So you're also extracting water out of these economies. And buying land from a country is not an easy process, because land is fought for. The liberation struggle in Zimbabwe was primarily also about land. In South Africa, it's about land. In other places, land. In Kenya, the independence struggle was about land. So why go back to a system that failed, that is so dangerous politically? The truth is that with neoliberal capitalism, that thinking, people have come to believe this is just an investment like any other. So you have to convince people that this is just a harmless investment. And a lot of these concessions range between 45 to 100 years. And once you have invested in land, it's not easy to give it back. It means you can renew the lease agreements or the ownership. So we have countries today that are giving out huge chunks of land, and Zambia is one of them. Uganda is one, Ethiopia, and many others. These are countries with very fertile, huge pieces of land, and a lot of water for irrigation. What I've talked about is all about the economy. So in our basic socialist literature, we are taught that's the economic base, but you have to build the superstructure. So imperialism is also working on the superstructure. And with that, they are the values, the basic values. You have to inculcate them also in the people that you're oppressing. And today, the values of individualism, greed, unbridled competition, and consumerism, these have become the standard diet for a lot of the literature that we get from the US, from Europe, and many other countries. You don't have to go far. Even the films, the soap operas that our children are watching, they are all about this. The magazines that look harmless, but when you look at them, it's all about this. So we have generations of Africans that are growing up thinking individualism and greed is the way to go. But part of the superstructure is also attacking the African working class. So a repressive instrument that oppresses, that fragments the working class is also in motion and has been going on for over 30 years now. I don't know of any African country whose labor laws have not changed over the past years. The laws are being changed to allow casualization. Laws are being changed to make it very difficult to organize trade unions. Laws are being changed where basically as a worker, you do not have permanent employment anymore. And the state itself is becoming more and more coercive also. So a lot of African countries are spending relatively huge amounts coming up with a very coercive state apparatus. I don't know of any country, any government today that's not doing that. Then there's also the militarization of the continent. This is the poorest continent in the world. It's being militarized at a very fast pace. African armies, which had deteriorated in the 80s under structure adjustment programs, today they are being rearmed. And the entry point was always the fight against. So the fight against terrorism was one of those entry points. It's even just visible today. If you look at most of those armies, look at their uniform, it reminds you of which uniform? The US, yes. It's changing. But it's not just the uniform, it's not just the common maneuvers, it's not just, but it's the whole doctrine. That's also changing. Out of the 54, 55 African countries, about 48 of them have got one or the other form of military cooperation with imperialist countries. It has about 63 points on the continent where it can launch an attack. I have to explain this. Those 63 points have to do with either it's a naval base, it's a military base, it's a support station, small unit for drones, it's a part of military intelligence, and so forth and so forth. There are that many scattered all over the continent and also in the small islands surrounding the continent. The US is capable of striking within 2 hours any place on the African continent. Within 2 hours. So if you talk of Africa Command or AFRICOM, that's how prepared they are. But they are not alone. Even the Europeans are also saying, we're being left behind. France is revisiting its presence on the continent, not by reducing, but by increasing and making it much smarter. And you have many other countries also that are saying, well, we won't be left behind. So even the Russians are coming in. Our Chinese comrades are also coming in. They are also building up their stations around there. So you have a continent that's being highly militarized. And this is dangerous. Highly dangerous, especially if you are pursuing a working class cause.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.